Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
So we're continuing in 1 Samuel. As we've looked at this before, 1 Samuel, we've seen Hannah, the faithful remnant, and her prayer. In beginning chapter 1, we see her prayer and praise in chapter 2, and then the introduction of Eli's wicked, worthless sons. And then, again, Samuel's woven in this tapestry of the story thus far. But we've seen also the prophecy of Eli's cracks in his legacy with Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons. Now we come to chapter 4. When you think things couldn't get any darker, they seem to turn very dark. So I'll be reading verses 1 to 10, and we'll focus on that to begin with. First Samuel 4, verses 1 to 10. And where the Lord came, the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines, all encamped at Ebenezer, and the Philistine encamped at Aphek. And the Philistines drew up in a line against Israel, and when the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who were killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle. And when the people came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies." So the people sent to Shiloh and brought from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who is enthroned on the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant. As soon as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel gave a mighty shout so that the earth resounded. When the Philistines heard the noise of the shouting, they said, "What does this great shouting in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" And when they learned that the Ark of the Lord had come to the camp, the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "A God has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us, who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been to you. Be men and fight." So Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and they fled, every man to his home. And there was a great slaughter, for 30,000 foot soldiers of Israel fell. It was, like we've said, almost every week a dark and depressing time in the nation of Israel. There was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. We see many kings, not just no king. There were many kings. Everyone thought they were their own king. But in this time, we've seen this small amber light begin, a breeze begin to blow on this amber. And we see this with Hannah and Samuel, this holy remnant, which is still amongst the nation of Israel, still faithful to Yahweh in amongst this dark and depressing time. However, this chapter seems to take a turn for the worse. When things get bad, they get worse. However, last week we saw that the house of Eli would crumble with the prophecy of Samuel again after the word of the Lord came to Eli the first time. Then it comes to Samuel, the prophet, as he begins his office of the prophet. Eli's house would crumble, that it would topple over, that God had raised up Samuel for such a time as this to be able to bring the word of the Lord to Eli. And we see this ember start to ignite again when Samuel was a prophet. The silence is broken. And then we see this relationship here in verse 1. And the word of the Lord came to, the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now, what's this relationship? Does this mean that the relationship between 4, verse 1, A is connected to chapter 3, or does this mean it's connected to chapter 4? I think probably it's connected to chapter 3. Some manuscripts show this more as part of 3:21 rather than 4:1. It's not saying that the word of the Lord came to Samuel to Israel and then they went out to battle. You can make that connection. I'm not really going to die on this hill. I think it's more connected to chapter 3 that we speak about the same location with Israel and Samuel. So really, you might be splitting hairs, but I think it's worth mentioning that connection is still there. But 4 verse 1 verse B shows Israel going out to war. Up to this point, Israel is referenced, but only a little bit. Israel's not really been the predominant person or the character, if you were to trying to categorize them. Israel really has been referenced. We saw this previously in 3 verse 20, and all Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was established as a prophet of the Lord. But really, Israel has not been mentioned. We've been focusing more people in Israel. We've seen Hannah and Samuel and Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, but not really about Israel. However, we see this shift where it becomes to talk about Israel now and the war of Israel against the Philistines. Now, up to this point, the Philistines have been mentioned from Genesis to Joshua about 14 times. But often as a reference more to a nation rather than to a nation seen as an enemy. Whereas in Joshua and in Genesis to Joshua, Egypt really takes the predominant person who as the nation who's considered the enemy. And then Canaan, when you shift to Joshua, really the Philistines aren't really mentioned. When we switch now to Judges going through the timeline, the frequency increases. It goes up to about 34 times. Samson fights the lords of the Philistines. So we've seen this increase where the Philistines are more mentioned as an enemy to Israel. But even in the book of Samuel, we'll see this increase even more. Between 1st and 2nd Samuel times, it will jump from 34 times in Judges to 152 times. The Philistines really become the contrast to the nation of Israel. And really, it's an important always to see these contrasts come up, not necessarily from our standpoint looking from nation to nation, but the people of God, the seed of Eve against the seed of the serpent. God's people compared to worldly, earthly people. That's the contrast that we're looking at. So the question really arises in 1 Samuel, who will defeat this enemy? Who will rise up and be the leader who will defeat the Philistines? Who will rise up and conquer them? It paints this picture which we see in Judges time and time again. The judges go through this judge cycle where Israel sins against the Lord, that they sin, they don't do what God has commanded them. Then they go from sinning to entering into a period of suffering and oppression. Normally that comes in the form of enemies coming in and taking over them. They go from sin to suffering to supplication. They cry out to God to save them. God raises up a judge to be able to save them. And then the fourth part of the cycle, salvation, comes. And this is what the cycle happens all throughout Judges. That they sin, they suffer, they cry out, and then salvation comes through the judges coming to deliver. And here we have the same cycle repeating itself. Israel is in sin. We've seen the wickedness and the corruption in the priesthood, that Israel even being wicked at the end of Judges. We haven't really seen that cycle of that that suffering step in, the supplication, them crying out. And this is that cycle from that end. We'll look at this more when we get to chapter 7. But these two nations are encamped at two locations. Ebenezer is where the Israelites are, and Aphek, which is where the Philistines are. Now, Ebenezer really just means Ebenezer, means stone of help. helper, when in Genesis, when God says, let's make a helper, it uses this word, ezer, to refer to a helper. And it's important. We'll remember this term when we get to chapter 7. And then aphek, the barrel of bones, or to be strong, or to shout. This is where the Philistines are. And this battle happens. In a movie, this would be a large scene where they would take their time to draw out this sword fight, chariots, racings, blood shed, the agony of Christ. However, this lineup is quite short. And Israel is defeated. 4,000 men died. Now, often in sporting things, I've mentioned this before, I really enjoy watching Formula One. And often in Formula One, one of the things they'll talk about in their post-race interviews is how they've got to go back to the team and debrief. They've got to go over what they did in the race and where they could have done better, what mistakes they made, so next time they're not making the same mistakes. And we see this, and it doesn't matter where you are. You might debrief after work, after going through a big project and seeing how you could improve different things. You might do this with sports, after a game, post-game debrief. All these different types of things they debrief. And this is what they do in verse 3, that people of the camp came, and the elders of the Israelites ask a question. Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Now, they ask the perfect questions. You notice they ask the question, why did the Lord defeat us today? Now, did the Lord fight them in the battle? Did Yahweh come down and with his sword conquer them? No, but they realize that God is still sovereign over them. Why did the Lord defeat us today? Now, they ask the perfect question. And often that's the case. We ask the perfect question, but we don't wait or try and find out the perfect answer to that question. But the Lord raised up the Philistines to be able to be used as a judgment on Israel. We see the sovereignty of God. We saw this in the book of Habakkuk, where the Lord was raising up the Babylonians, the Chaldeans, to come in to be able to carry out his sovereign will. But like I said, they ask the right question, but they come to the wrong conclusion. They look to outward appearances rather than the heart of the issue. They don't see that sin is a part of the problem of the wickedness in their nation. They don't see the corrupt nature of themselves that are rebelling against God and rebelling against Him, the one who has given them the Lord. That's not the problem. They think the problem is they didn't have the Ark of the Covenant with them. They basically go back and say, let us recreate all the times that we've battled and we've won in the past. They know their history with having the Ark at their side and their voices to be able to shout. They might think of Gideon in the times of Judges when he went and defeated a great army with a small army of himself. They might think of Joshua crossing into Jericho to be able to defeat the walls of Jericho just by walking around and being loud at the end. And they say that he may be able to come among us and save us from the power of their enemies. They look to their outward appearances. They don't stop and dwell on the sin. But it's also important to note that who is carrying the Ark of the Covenant? The two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. It's interesting that the author of Samuel, which is Samuel at this point, makes this connection that here we are. They're saying, let's put the Ark there. But let's put it with some corrupt, worthless priests who don't even know the Lord. Interesting to think about that. They are the exact example of the wickedness that happens, that is the center of Israel. Let's put our best men forward in our wickedness, is basically how they are saying it. So they take the Ark into the battlefield and they shout like they've done in the past against the Philistines. And they were afraid. They were afraid for their life because they've heard of the stories of the Israelites. How a small nation with no military power conquered the Egyptians. They cry out, woe to us. Who can deliver us from this power? And their solution, like any other person, is be men and fight with manpower. This is how we're going to conquer this small nation with a great God. They're in battle against men, and Israel would normally be defeated in this case. So they fled, and it was a great slaughter of 30,000 foot soldiers, and they were defeated. They went in with all this external appearances. My life was not as bad when I went to church as maybe what we might do. My life is not going too well. So we turn to external appearances to go to church, to get our appearances up in front of people, to appear like we're doing the right thing, that we tithe, we pray, we do all these things externally like the Pharisees did. But it's not about the heart, which is a constant thing that we come up in this book, the heart of the matter, not this outward appearances. That they take the ark in as a manner to be able to just bring back memories of what has happened in the past. But the important thing is that when we see all these great things in the past, it's not that the Israelites had these great military tactics that then defeated the enemy. It was always God using these ordinary means to be able to conquer these great enemies. It was always God and His power being able to defeat them. It was never the actual means in which they used which defeated it. It was how God used them to be able to defeat the enemies. Now, it's very interesting to stop and think about sin. Something we might say sin is something that you do. But, I mean, you look even at the Tenth Commandment, and the Tenth Commandment is do not covet. Coveting isn't really something you do with your hands, with your actions. It's something that's internal. And that's a big heart thing that we need to understand when we look at sin. Sin is not only an action that we do, but it's in our heart. That's where it starts, and that's what sin actually is. There can be internal sin, not just outward sin, but internal sin, and fixing the outward appearance doesn't actually fix the rotten heart. We'll see this later when we look at Saul and his legacy. But here the Israelites are quick to carry the ark to make loud noises. But don't really care if God is with them. They don't really care if they're God's holy people. They're not willing to pray the silent prayer like Hannah at the start. They're quick to just jump in. Now, they're defeated. But this leads to the second part of the story, which is found in verses 11 and 20. Now, this really is a chapter of death. It's grim. It's not uplifting, really. It's a story of death where 30,000, 34,000 people have died, but now we come to five new deaths. So, 1 Samuel 4:11-20. And the ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. A man of Benjamin ran from the battle line and came to Shiloh the same day, with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. When he arrived, Eli was sitting on his seat by the road watching, for his heart trembled for the ark of God. And when the man came into the city and told the news, all the city cried out. When Eli heard the sound of the outcry, he said, "What is this uproar?" And the man hurried and came and told Eli. Now Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were set so that he could not see. And the man said to Eli, "I am he who has come from the battle. I fled from the battle today." And he said, "How did it go, my son?" He who brought the news answered and said, "Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there has also been a great defeat among the people. Your two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the ark of the God has been captured." As soon as he mentioned the ark of God, Eli fell over backward from his seat by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken and he died. For the man was old and heavy. He had judged Israel 40 years. Now his daughter-in-law, the wife of Phinehas, was pregnant, about to give birth, and when she heard the news that the ark of God was captured, and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she bowed and gave birth, and her pains came upon her. And about the time of her death, the women attending her said to her, "Do not be afraid, for you have borne a son." but she did not answer or pay attention. Here we see five deaths. The first is the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas. Now, we're not surprised by this. We've been warned about this. We never really have good feelings about them when they're first introduced in chapter 2. We see them in verse 3, and they're just mentioned out of passing in 1 verse 3. But in chapter 2, when they're introduced to them, the sons of Eli were worthless men. And they did not know the Lord. You don't go in batting for them. You're not choosing them on your side. You don't really have good feelings about them. We're not surprised because God had already said in 1 Samuel 2:33 that they would die by the sword. They would die on the same day. And this is the promise which God told to Eli. This is what would happen to your house. That all the descendants of your house shall die by the sword of men. We're not surprised by these two deaths. The second death we see is Eli. Eli is 98 years old. His eyesight is poor. This is something that has come up over and over again, but finally he is blind. He's unable to see. But he's able to hear the reports of his sons. See this? He knows that this is true, this is what's come to pass in 2:22. Now, Eli was very old and he kept hearing all that the sons were doing in Israel. He'd heard of what their sons had done in the past. And he heard the word of the Lord when it came to him in 2 verse 34. This shall come upon your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. They shall be assigned to you. Both of them shall die on the same day. God keeps his promise to Eli. He hears not only the news of his two sons, but he hears the news of the ark. And it's not the surprise of his two sons dying that he's surprised by. It's the news that the ark was captured. We see this As soon as the ark, he had mentioned the ark of God, Eli fell over backwards. As soon as he heard this news, he fell over backwards. And one of the responsibilities of the priest was to be able to make sacrifices, but also there were caretakers of the temple. There were caretakers of the ark. Now imagine having this prized possession, which is a part of your job to be able to protect. This boss gives you a nice Ferrari or a nice Maserati or something to look after. And on your watch, someone takes it. You know, when you're meant to be looking after it, then someone else takes it. And this is what had happened to Eli. Now, not only was he old, but he was also heavy. Now, why is this important? Often, the Bible doesn't really mention appearances. We don't really get to know about eye color or height or build a lot of the time. A lot of the times it's more just talking about a person. But here it mentions his weight. Why is that important? Because what were his two sons doing in chapter 2? They were taking the offerings of the Lord before they were burnt. They were feeding on the offerings. They were feasting. They were feeding their souls. They were becoming fat on the offerings of the Lord before they were meant to be offering to the Lord. But not only their sons was doing it, we see signs now that Eli was a part of this. That he was happy to rebuke his sons, but he was also partaking of what they were doing. That he was heavy. That he was, this really is a sign of external wealth. We don't think of heaviness as a great asset today, but heaviness back then shows that you had a lot of food to eat. That you were doing quite well for yourself. So this is what Eli was. And he judged Israel 40 years. Now, we don't normally mention, we'll kind of talk about this when we get to chapter 7 again. But we don't normally, when we look at the judges, we think judges happened in the period of the judges, which is in the book of Judges. But in reality, the book of Judges really should probably continue into 1 Samuel. That we see the same cycle happening with these judges, that Eli was a judge, not only a priest. So he judged Israel 40 years. Now, we've looked at this a lot as we go through this. Eli is a hard person to peg. We know where Hophni and Phinehas lie. We know where Hannah lies when it comes to their knowledge of God and their worship, their devotion to God. Whereas Eli is another person. It's hard to know. He's not necessarily painted as an evil person, but a lot of things come back to Eli. You see this mentioned a lot, that it's Eli's sons, that it's Eli's daughter-in-law. First and foremost, it's Eli and his house. It's Eli and his sons. So we see a somewhat godly picture of him. We remember him worshiping the Lord at the end of chapter 1. We see him worshiping the Lord. We see him give good advice to Samuel. He proclaims accurate blessings over Hannah twice. But it seems that he loved his sons more than he loved God and God's holiness. We saw him try to rebuke his sons, but he really didn't carry it out. But he wasn't willing to step in and to take action. He wasn't willing to stop them serving in the temple, to cast them out of the people of God. And we looked at this last week, that he knew what his sons were doing. His sons were blaspheming God, and he did not restrain them. He did not do enough. That might paint a picture of a pastor of a church now, and their son is serving as an assistant pastor or something like this, and the assistant pastor isn't really living a godly, holy life. He might have an affair with someone. He might be embezzling money. Obviously he's corrupt, but the father, the minister, doesn't carry through with that to be able to proceed with church discipline. Obviously, that's just a one-to-one correlation. We would have a presbytery to be able to go back to, a session that would be able to step in. But that's kind of the picture of what is happening here. That Eli knew what his sons were doing. He knew that they were blaspheming God, but he did not restrain them. He did not go far enough. That we see sin not if just sin is something that you do, but sin is something sometimes that you don't do. There's the sin of omission, not doing something, and the sin of commission, doing something. The Children's Catechism asks the question, what is sin? Sin is any lack of conformity to or transgression of the law of God. Now, it's interesting to have kids ask that question. What does lack of conformity to or transgression of the law of God mean? And that's why we go into the next two questions. What does it mean by the lack of conformity? Not being or doing what God requires. What is meant by the lack of transgression? Doing what God forbids. And often we think of sin not just as an external thing. There's the external thing and then there's the heart matter, which we looked at before. But we also just see it as a transgression. That's how we doing what God forbids. We do the Ten Commandments. Often they are God forbids something and we do that. And therefore that is sin. But also a lack of conformity means not being or doing what God requires. That this is really what Eli's sin is. Obviously, he has that transgression there. It seems that he's enabling his sons, that he's eating the forbidden, the offering before it's offered to the Lord, that he's sinning in that way. But more so, that he's doing a lack of conformity, not being or doing what God requires. He's not carrying out his holy living by living how God has told them to do. So, again, it's hard to be able to peg where Eli is. Eli, I think, whether we will see in heaven, it seems that his household is not necessarily painted that he's the evil, corrupt one. It seems that he had some form of faith in God, whether it was an external faith or not. We're not necessarily sure. But we see the collapse of Eli and therefore his house. But there's the fourth death. And that comes in Eli's daughter-in-law. Now, again, it's interesting to mention that it's Eli's daughter-in-law, not Phinehas' wife, that is mentioned first. She's first Eli's daughter-in-law. That, again, you see that common marker throughout, that Eli is the one, although his sons are sinning, Eli is the one that is responsible and accountable to God. We see this in the New Testament, where it says that not all of you should consider be teachers, because they would face double judgment. We see the extra weight and responsibility placed on leaders, and especially that you see this in this with Eli. But Eli's daughter-in-law, pregnant near giving birth, she finds out about the ark. Again, she it's not the surprise about her father-in-law dying. It's not the surprise about her husband dying that she gives birth and she passes away. It's because the ark of the Lord was captured. We see this dark time, and we'll get to that soon. But the fifth death that is not really directly mentioned here, but I think it's worth noting, is the death of Shiloh. That Shiloh really drops off the map after this time. Shiloh was the center point where the Ark of the Covenant was, where Eli lived. Shiloh was mentioned a lot throughout this passage up to first this in chapter 4. But really, there's this death of Shiloh. And when it's mentioned in after this time, it's mentioned in a negative sense. Jeremiah 7:12 says, "Now go to my place that was in Shiloh, where I made my name dwell at first, and see what I did to it because of the evil of my people Israel." And when you continues in 13 and 14, "Now, because you have done all these things, declares the Lord, and when I spoke to you persistently, you did not listen. And when I called you, you did not answer. Therefore, I will do to the house that is called by my name, in which you trust, and the place that I gave you and your fathers, as I did to Shiloh." That Shiloh is really painted as a negative picture. Negative picture because of what has actually happened here. That where God was meant to dwell, where God's holiness was meant to be reflected in the people of God, corruption grew out of there. Again, in Jeremiah 26:9, it says, "Why have you prophesied in the name of the Lord, saying, this house shall be like Shiloh, for the city shall be desolate without inhabitant. And all the people gathered around Jeremiah in the house of the Lord." This great sorrow comes at this point to think about Shiloh, this great height. But the outward appearance reflects what has happened inwardly. They were dead. And this is what happened to Shiloh. That's the fruit of their labor. Shiloh, the house in which the house that God used to dwell, is now dead, desolate. This is an image, a picture for the people of Israel to look back on and to see their corruption and to turn back and not be like that. Shiloh is that fifth death. So we've seen them defeated. We've seen the death in these five deaths. However, I think the greatest sorrow is not found in Israel being defeated. The greatest sorrow is not found in the death of Eli's house. But the greatest sorrow is when we find out in this narrative that the Lord actually departed. And we see this in verses 21 and 22. "And she named the child Ichabod, saying, the glory has departed from Israel, because the ark of God had been captured, and because of her father-in-law and her husband. And she said, the glory of God has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been captured." Now you just think about this contrast of Hannah, and Hannah giving birth to her son, Samuel, and great rejoicing in that moment when she conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Samuel, for she said, "I have asked for him from the Lord." This great celebration found in Samuel to this contrast found in Ichabod. The closing of chapter 4 is dark and depressing. When you think at times could not get any worse, they do. There's this shift that happens in chapter 4. That 12 times the Ark of the Covenant is actually, and the Ark of God is referenced 12 times in this chapter. We've seen Hannah take the spotlight. We've seen Samuel take the spotlight. We've seen Eli and his sons take the spotlight. But now there's a shift, and this shift happens in chapter 4 all the way to chapter 7. And it centers around the Ark of the Covenant. Why is it important to understand that the glory has departed and what the Ark actually represents? Firstly, that there's no presence. The truth about the defeat was not that the ark was not there to begin with. Because once the ark entered the battle, more people actually lost their life. It was God was not there. God was not with them. The ark was not some magical battle-conquering military device with a force shield that helped protect the Israelites. The reason the Israelites have won so many battles against stronger armies is because of the Lord, not because of the ark. Exodus 25, verses 8 to 10 says, "And let them make me a sanctuary, that I may dwell in their midst, exactly as I show you concerning the pattern of the tabernacle and all of its furniture. So you shall make it. They shall make an ark of acacia wood. 2 cubits and a half shall be its length, a cubit and a half its breadth, and a cubit and a half its height." But the ark really wasn't the actual presence of God, but it was a physical representation of Him dwelling amongst their people. But they sought to use God as some form of cosmic vending machine that they would come in and bring when they needed Him. It wasn't that they wished for God to dwell amongst them and be in their presence all the time. They just only sought Him when they needed Him, when they thought that they might need to be defeated, when they defeat the Philistines, that this is when they would go to God and cry for help. What a great warning that is for us, that we should constantly seek to be in God's presence, not just when we need Him, not just turning to Him at the 11th hour, but constantly having the presence of God before Him, that He might dwell in our midst. So the first issue with the glory departing is that there is no presence. The second is that there is no king. We've seen this constantly, time and time again. In those days, there was no king in Israel, the end of Judges 21. And everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And 1 Samuel tries to answer this question, why there is no king in Israel. But we've mentioned this time and time again, that there was actually many kings. That was the issue. Everyone just was their own king. But God was not their king. God had given them the law, which was to be kept in the ark, along with Aaron's staff and the pot of manna, which is, we find that in Hebrews 9:4. The disappearing of the ark is a physical sign of what actually happened in their physical reality. Instead of doing what was right in the eyes of the Lord, they did what was right in their own eyes, that they were their own kings. The departure of the ark of God was really just how they had been living all along. That they had got rid of the law of God in their lives. And this was just a physical reality of what they already did. Prior to the commissioning of the ark, they find the promise of the people to the promise of Israel in Exodus 24:3. And Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the rules. And all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words that the Lord has spoken, we will do." It's the promise, the vow that they made before God. But they didn't. They rebelled. They were wicked. They were corrupt. They didn't obey God's law. They didn't keep God's law. They didn't have God as king. And this, I think, is an important part. With the departure of the ark was also the departure of the Ten Commandments with them. But thirdly, and I think the greatest issue, was no God. But really, it was a taste of what is coming. The glory departing. Again, right before the ark was commissioned in Exodus 25, we find this verse in 15 and 18. Moses went up to the mountain and the cloud covered them. The glory of the Lord dwelt on Mount Sinai. The glory covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day, He called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. Now the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a devouring fire on the top of a mountain in the sight of the people of Israel. Moses entered the cloud and went up into the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. When the glory was with the commandments, the glory was passed down. that the glory had departed. The ark had been captured. Ichabod, the glory has departed. Maybe a better translation would be the glory has gone into exile. We'll look at this next week as well. We see the echoes of Exodus in these next few chapters. We see almost the reverse happens. They leave exile and have the glory come in Exodus 24, and now we see the glory exit and the ark go back into exile. We really shouldn't be surprised at this happening. This is really just a representation of what is this dark and depressing time. They shouldn't be caught off guard that the glory had departed, because really they didn't need God's glory. Didn't even think about it. Israel was not being the people of God. They were people of God's. We saw this when the Philistines mentioned them in 4 verse 8. Woe to us, who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians in every sort of plague in the wilderness. That we see them being exactly like the other nations. They don't even know who this God is. When the Philistines go and fight them in battle, you know, they don't even know that God is God, Yahweh. Deuteronomy 6:4, Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. But they're just looking like other nations. Just in this statement, we see the commandments that they have broken. The first three commandments. We see this in Exodus 20. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Commandment 1. You shall not take the name of the Lord God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Number 3. What is it that Hophni and Phinehas did? They blasphemed the Lord. They were just acting like other godless nations. And when you act like it soon enough, you become one. You become what you worship. They worshipped wickedness. This is a dark and depressing time. Chapter 4, it's not a coffee cup verse. You don't call your son Ichabod. The people of God go from the people of God to just people without a God. There was no presence, there was no king, but no God. And over the next couple of chapters, we'll see what happens to the Ark of the Covenant. But it's a dark and depressing time. When we've talked about this dark and depressing time before, it's all leading up to this. This, I think, is one of the lowest times in Israel's history. But as we see, it doesn't end in chapter 4. There's more coming. And that's the great thing that we have to look forward to next week.
Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America, located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.